So today I'm going to do some reading from Upasaka Ghi, and I'm offering this in honor of Iris, who was an Upasaka, who moved to be near to the monastery to deepen her practice, and I for one saw results of that effort in her. So offer this in her honor. Just wanted to give a little bit of a background about Upasaka Ghi. For those who don't know, we actually, during a winter retreat, I think it was like 2004, it was one of the books that was read during the retreat. she was a laywoman who was born in 1901 in Rajpuri, a town west of Bangkok. Ajahn Jeff calls her the foremost woman Dhamma teacher in 20th century Thailand. She started her practice at an early age. Her mother taught her the rudiments of Buddhist practice, such as nightly chants and precepts. During her teens, she devoted all her spare time to Dhamma books and to meditation. And her working hours were spent running a small store and in order to support her father in his old age, which she continued to do after his death. And the thought then was saving enough money so that when she had enough, she could enable herself to live the remainder of her life in a secluded place, giving herself fully to the practice. At the age of 44, she was able to move out, and she moved with her aunt and uncle to an abandoned monastic dwelling on a hill near their home, and they began to live their lives as upasikas and an upasika, devoted female and male devotees of the Buddha. And although she picked up the rudiments of meditation during her frequent visits to monasteries during her youth, most of her practice and learning was on her own without formal study under a meditation teacher. And again, in Ajahn Jeff's words, most of her instruction came from books, the Pali Canon, and the works of contemporary teachers, and was tested in the crucible of her own relentless honesty. She died at the age of 77, in 1978, and as of the printing of this book, which was 2005, the center that she and her aunt and uncle began was being run by a committee and was able to accommodate up to 60 people staying there. Reading the mind. Discernment versus self-deception. It's important that we discuss the steps of the practice in training the mind. For the mind has all sorts of deceptions by which it fools itself. If you aren't skillful in investigating and seeing through them, they are very difficult to overcome, even if you're continually mindful to keep watch over the mind. You have to make an effort to contemplate these things at all times. Mindfulness on its own won't be able to give rise to any real knowledge. At best, it can give you only a little protection against the effects of sensory contact. If you don't make a focused contemplation, the mind won't be able to give rise to any knowledge within itself at all. This is why you have to train yourself to be constantly aware all around. When you come to know anything for what it really is, there's nothing but letting go, letting go. On the beginning level, this means the mind won't give rise to any unwise or unskillful thoughts. It will simply stop to watch, stop to know within itself. If there's anything you have to think about, keep your thoughts on the themes of inconstancy, stress, and not self. You have to keep the mind thinking and labeling solely in reference to these sorts of themes. For if your thinking and labeling are right, you'll come to see things rightly. If you go the opposite way and label things wrongly, you'll see things wrongly as well. This keeps the mind completely hidden from itself. Now, when thoughts or labels arise in the mind, then if you focus on watching them closely, you'll see that they're sensations. Sensations of arising and disbanding, changeable, unreliable, and illusory. If you don't make an effort to keep a focused watch on them, you'll fall for the deceptions of thought fabrication. In other words, the mind gives rise to memories of the past and fashions issues dealing with the past. But if you're aware of what's going on in time, you'll see that they're all illusory. There's no real truth to them at all. even the meanings the mind gives to good and bad sensory contacts at the moment they occur. If you carefully observe and contemplate them, you'll see that they're all deceptive. There's no real truth to them. But ignorance and delusion latch onto them, and this drives the mind around in circles. It doesn't know what's what, how these things arise, persist, and disband. So it latches onto them and gets itself deceived on many, many levels. If you don't stop and focus, there's no way you can see through these things. But if the mind keeps its balance, stopping to watch and know itself, it realizes these things for what they are. When it does that, it lets them go automatically without being attached. This is the knowledge that comes with true mindfulness and discernment. It knows and lets go. It doesn't cling. No matter what appears, good or bad, pleasure or pain, when the mind knows, it doesn't cling. When it doesn't cling, there's no stress or suffering. You have to keep hammering away at this point. When it doesn't cling, the mind can stay at normalcy, empty, undisturbed, and quiet. But if it doesn't read and know itself in this way, it will fall for the deceits of defilement and craving. It will conjure up all sorts of complex and complicated things that it will then have a hard time seeing through, for they have their ways of playing up to the mind to keep it attached to them, all of which is simply a matter of the mind's falling for the deceits of the defilements and cravings within itself. The fact that it isn't acquainted with itself, doesn't know how mental states arise and disband and take on objects, means that it loses itself in its many, many attachments. There's nothing as hard to keep watch of as the mind, because it's so accustomed to wrong views and wrong opinions. This is what keeps it hidden from itself. But thanks to the teachings of the Buddha, we can gain knowledge into the mind or into consciousness with its many layers and intricacies, which when you look into it deeply, you'll find to be empty, empty of any meaning in and of itself. This is an emptiness that can appear clearly within consciousness. Even though it's hidden and profound, we can see into it by looking inward in a way that's quiet and still. The mind stops to watch, to know within itself. As for sensory contacts, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and that sort of thing, it isn't interested because it's intent on looking into consciousness, pure and simple, to see what arises in there and how it generates issues. Sensations, thoughts, labels for pleasure and pain, and so forth, are all natural phenomena that change as soon as they're sensed. And they're very refined. If you view them as being about this or that matter, you won't be able to know them for what they are. The more intricate the meanings you give them, the more lost you become, lost in the whirls of the cycle of rebirth. The cycle of rebirth and the process of thought fabrications are one and the same thing. As a result, we whirl around and around, lost in many, many levels of thought fabrication, not just one. The knowledge that would read the heart can't break through, for it whirls around and around in these very same thought fabrications, giving them meaning in terms of this or that, and then latching onto them. If it labels them as good, it latches onto them as good. If it labels them as bad, it latches onto them as bad. This is why the mind stays entirely in the whirls of the cycle of rebirth, the cycle of thought fabrication. To see these things clearly requires the effort to stop and watch, to stop and know in an appropriate way, in a way that's just right. At the same time, you have to use your powers of observation. That's what will enable you to read your own consciousness in a special way. Otherwise, if you latch onto the issues of thoughts and labels, they'll keep you spinning around. So you have to stop and watch. Stop and know clearly by focusing. Focusing on the consciousness in charge. That way your knowledge will become skillful. Ultimately, you'll see that there's nothing at all, just the arising and disbanding, occurring every moment in emptiness. If there's no attachment, there are no issues. There's simply the natural phenomenon of rising and disbanding. But because we don't see things simply as natural phenomena, we see them as being true and latch onto them as self, as good or bad, and as all sorts of complicated things. This keeps us spinning around without knowing how to find a way out or what to let go of. We just don't know. When we don't know, we're like a person who wanders into a jungle and can't find the way out. Actually, what we have to let go of lies right smack in front of us. where the mind fashions things and gives them meanings so that it doesn't know the characteristics of arising and disbanding, pure and simple. If you can simply keep watching and knowing without any need for meanings, thoughts, imaginings, simply watching the process itself, there won't be any issues. There's just the phenomenon of the present, arising, persisting, disbanding, arising, persisting, disbanding. There's no special trick to this, but you have to stop and watch. Stop and know within yourself at every moment. Don't let your awareness stream away from awareness to outside preoccupations. Gather it in so it can know itself clearly, that there's nothing in there worth latching onto. It's all a mass of deceit. To know just this much is very useful for seeing the truth inside yourself. You'll see that consciousness is empty of any self. When you look at physical phenomena, you'll see them as elements, as empty of self. You'll see mental phenomena as empty of self, as elements of consciousness. And you'll see that if there's no attachment, no latching on, there's no suffering or stress. So even if there's thinking going on in the mind, simply watch it, let it go, and its cycling will slow down. Fewer and fewer thought fabrications will occur. Even if the mind doesn't stop completely, it will form fewer and fewer thoughts. You'll be able to stop and watch, stop and know more and more. And this way you'll come to see the tricks and deceits of thought fabrication, mental labels, pleasure and pain, and so on. You'll be able to know that there's really nothing inside, that the reason you were deluded into latching onto things was your ignorance, and that you made yourself suffer right there in that very ignorance. So you have to focus on one point, one thing. Focusing on many things won't do. Keep mindfulness in place, stopping, knowing, seeing. Don't let it run out after thoughts and labels. But knowing in this way requires that you make the effort to stay focused. Focused on seeing clearly, not just focused on making the mind still. Focus on seeing clearly. Look inside to see clearly and contemplate how to let go. The mind will become empty in line with its nature in a way that you'll know exclusively within. A difference in the knowing. What can we do to see the aggregates, this mass of suffering and stress, so clearly that we can cut attachments for them out of the mind? Why is it that people studying to be doctors can know everything in the body, intestines, liver, kidneys, and all, down to the details, and yet don't develop any dispassion or disenchantment for it? Why? Why is it that undertakers can spend their time with countless corpses and yet not gain any insight at all? This shows that insight is hard to attain. If there's no mindfulness and discernment to see things clearly for what they are, knowledge is simply a passing fancy. It doesn't sink in. The mind keeps latching onto its attachments. But if the mind can gain true insight to the point where it can relinquish its attachments, it can gain the paths and fruitions leading to nibbana. This shows that there's a difference in the knowing. It's not that we have to know all the details like modern-day surgeons. All we have to know is that the body is composed of the four physical elements plus the elements of space and consciousness. If we really know just this much, we've reached the paths and their fruitions, while those who know all the details, to the point where they can perform fine surgery, don't reach any transcendent attainments at all. So let's analyze the body into its elements so as to know them thoroughly. If we do, then when there are changes in the body and mind, there won't be too much clinging. If we don't, our attachments will be fixed and strong and will lead to future states of being and birth. Now that we have the opportunity, we should contemplate the body and take it apart to get down to the details. Take the five basic meditation objects, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, and look at them carefully, one at a time. You don't have to take on all five, you know. Focus on the hair of the head to see that it belongs to the earth element, to see that its roots are soaked in blood and lymph under the skin. It's unattractive in terms of its color, its smell, and where it dwells. If you analyze and contemplate these things, you won't be deluded into regarding them as yours, your hair, your nails, your teeth, your skin. All of these parts are composed of the earth element mixed in with water, wind, and fire. If they were purely earth, they wouldn't last, because every part of the body has to be composed of all four elements for it to be a body. And then there's a mental phenomenon, the mind in charge. These are things that follow in line with nature. The arising, changing, and disbanding of physical and mental phenomena. But we latch onto them, seeing the body as ours. The mental phenomena is us. It's all us and ours. If we don't see these things for what they are, we'll do nothing but cling to them. This is what meditation is, seeing things clearly for what they are. It's not a matter of switching from topic to topic, for that would simply ensure that you wouldn't know a thing. But our inner character, under the sway of ignorance and delusion, doesn't like examining itself repeatedly. It keeps finding other issues to get in the way, so that we think constantly about other things. This is why we stay so ignorant and foolish. Then why is it that we can know other things? Because they fall in line with what craving wants. To see things clearly for what they are would be to abandon craving, so it finds ways of keeping things hidden. It keeps changing, bringing in new things, keeping us fooled, so that we study and think about nothing but matters that add to the mind's suffering and stress. That's all that craving wants. As for the kind of study that would end the stress and suffering in the mind, it's always getting in craving's way. This is why the mind is always wanting to shift to new things to know, new things to fall for, and this is why it's always becoming attached. So when it doesn't really know itself, you have to make a real effort to see the truth that the things within it aren't you or yours. Don't let the mind stop short of this knowledge. Make this a law within yourself. If the mind doesn't know the truths of inconstancy, stress, and not self within itself, it won't gain release from suffering. Its knowledge will be worldly knowledge. It will follow a worldly path. It won't reach the paths and fruition leading to Nibbana. So this is where the worldly and the transcendent part ways. If you comprehend inconstancy, stress, and not self to the ultimate degree, that's the transcendent. If you don't get down to their details, you're still on the worldly level. The Buddha has many teachings, but this is what they all come down to. The important principles of the practice, the four establishings of mindfulness, the four noble truths, all come down to these characteristics of inconstancy, stress, and not-selfness. If you try to learn too many principles, you'll end up with no clear knowledge of the truth as it is. If you focus on knowing just a little, you'll end up with more true insight than if you try knowing a lot. It's through wanting to know too many things that we end up deluded. We wander around in our deluded knowledge, thinking and labeling things. But knowledge that is focused and specific when it really knows is absolute. It keeps hammering away at one point. There's no need to know a lot of things, for when you really know one thing, everything converges right there. The balanced way. In practicing the Dhamma, if you don't foster a balance between concentration and discernment, you'll end up going wild in your thinking. If there's too much working at discernment, you'll go wild in your thinking. But if there's too much concentration, the mind just stays still and undisturbed without coming to any knowledge. So you have to keep discernment and stillness in balance. Don't let there be too much of one or the other. Try to get them just right. That's when you'll be able to see things clearly all the way through. Otherwise, you'll stay as deluded as ever. You may want to gain discernment into too many things, and as a result, your thinking goes wild. Some people keep wondering why discernment never arises in their practice, but when it does, they really go off on a tangent. Their thinking goes wild, all out of bounds. So when you practice, you have to observe in your meditation how you can make the mind still. Once it does grow still, it tends to get stuck there. Or it may become empty, without any knowledge of anything, quiet, disengaged, at ease for a while, but without any discernment to accompany it. But if you can get discernment to accompany your concentration, that's when you'll really benefit. You'll see things all the way through and be able to let them go. If you're too heavy on the side of either discernment or stillness, you can't let go. The mind may come to know this or that, but it latches onto its knowledge. Then it knows still other things and latches onto them too. Or else it simply stays perfectly quiet and latches onto that. It's not easy to keep your practice on the middle way. If you don't use your powers of observation, it's especially hard. The mind will keep falling for things, sometimes right, sometimes wrong, because it doesn't observe what's going on. This isn't the path to letting go. It's a path to getting stuck, caught up in things. If you don't know what it's stuck and caught up in, you'll remain foolish and deluded. So make an effort at focused contemplation until you see clearly into inconstancy, stress, and not self. This, without a doubt, will stop every moment of suffering and stress. The uses of equanimity. The sensations of the mind are subtle and very volatile. Sometimes passion or irritation can arise independently of sensory contact, simply in line with one's character. For instance, there are times when the mind is perfectly normal and all of a sudden there's irritation, or there's a desire to form thoughts and get engrossed in feelings of pain, pleasure, or equanimity. We have to contemplate these three kinds of feelings to see how they're inconstant, always changing, and stressful, so that the mind won't go and get engrossed in them. This business of getting engrossed is subtle. It keeps us from knowing what's what. It's delusion, pure and simple. Being engrossed in feelings of pleasure is relatively easy to detect. But being engrossed in feelings of equanimity, that's hard to notice if the mind is at equanimity in an oblivious way. This oblivious equanimity keeps us from seeing anything clearly. So you have to focus on seeing feelings simply as feelings and pull the mind out of its infatuation with equanimity. When there's a feeling of equanimity as the mind gathers and settles down, use that feeling of equanimity and concentration as the basis for probing into inconstancy, stress, and not-self. For this equanimity and concentration at the fourth level of absorption is the basis for liberating insight. Simply make sure that you don't get attached to the absorption. If you get the mind to grow still in equanimity without focusing on gaining insight, you achieve only a temporary state of concentration. So you have to focus on gaining clear insight either into inconstancy, into stress, or into not-selfness. That's when you'll be able to uproot your attachments. If the mind gets into a state of oblivious equanimity, it's still carrying fuel inside it. Then as soon as there's sensory contact, it flares up into attachment. So we have to follow the principles the Buddha laid down. Focus the mind into a state of absorption and then focus on gaining clear insight into the three characteristics. The proper way to practice is not to let yourself get stuck on this level or that. And no matter what insights you may gain, don't go thinking that you've gained awakening. Keep looking, keep focusing, and see if there are any further changes in the mind. And if there are, see the stress and the not-selfness of those changes. If you can know that in this way, the mind will rise above feeling, no longer entangled in this or that, this level or that level, all of which are simply matters of speculation. The important thing is that you try to see clearly. Even when the mind is fabricating all sorts of objects in a real turmoil, see these objects as illusory. Then stay still and watch their disbanding. See clearly that there's really nothing to them. They all disband. All that remains is the empty mind, the mind maintaining its balance and normalcy. Focus on examining that. There are many levels of examining the diseases in the mind, not just one. If you come up with a genuine insight, don't stop there, and don't get excited about seeing things you never saw before. Just keep contemplating the theme of inconstancy in everything, without latching on, and then you'll come to even more penetrating insights. So keep focusing until the mind stops, until it reaches the stage of absorption called purity of mindfulness and equanimity. See what pure mindfulness is like. As for the feeling of equanimity, that's an affair of concentration. It's what the mindfulness depends on so that it too can reach equanimity. This is the stage where we consolidate our awareness in order to come in and know the mind. Get the mind centered at equanimity and then probe in and contemplate. That's when you'll be able to see. A glob of tar. An important but subtle point in our practice is that we continue to fall for pleasant feelings because feelings are illusory on many levels. We don't realize that they're changeable and unreliable. Instead of offering pleasure, they offer us nothing but stress, yet you're still addicted to them. This business of feeling is thus a subtle matter. Please contemplate it carefully, this business of latching onto feelings of pleasure, pain, or equanimity. You have to contemplate it and see it clearly, and you have to experiment more than you may want to with pain. When there are feelings of physical pain or mental distress, the mind will struggle because it doesn't like pain. But when pain turns to pleasure, the mind likes it and is content with it. So it keeps on playing with feeling, even though, as we've said, feeling is inconstant, stressful, and not really ours. But the mind doesn't see this. All it sees are feelings of pleasure, and it wants them. Try looking into how feeling gives rise to craving. It's because we want pleasant feelings that craving whispers right there at the feeling. If you observe carefully, you'll see that this is very important, for this is where the paths and fruitions leading to Nibbana are attained, right here at feeling and craving. If we can extinguish the craving and feeling, that's Nibbana. In the Solasa Panha, Sutta Nipata 5, the Buddha said that defilement is like a wide and deep flood, but he then summarized the practice of crossing this flood simply as abandoning craving in every action. Now, right here at feeling is where we can practice abandoning craving, for the way we relish the flavor of feeling has many ramifications. This is where many of us get deceived, because we don't see feeling as inconstant. We want it to be constant. We want pleasant feelings to be constant. As for pain, we don't want it to be constant, but no matter how much we push it away, we still latch onto it. We have to focus on feeling so that we can abandon craving right there in the feeling. If you don't focus here, the other paths you follow will simply proliferate. So bring the practice close to home. When the mind gains a sense of stillness or a feeling of pleasure or equanimity, try to see how the pleasure or equanimity is inconstant, how it's not you or yours. When you can do this, you'll stop relishing that particular feeling. You can stop right there, right where the mind relishes the flavor of feeling and gives rise to craving. This is why the mind has to be fully aware of itself, all around, at all times, in its focused contemplation to see feeling as empty of self. This business of liking and disliking feeling is a disease hard to detect, because our intoxication with feelings is so very strong. Even with the sensations of peace and emptiness in the mind, we're still infatuated with feeling. Feelings on the crude level, the violent and stressful ones that come with defilement, are easy to detect. But when the mind grows still, steady, cool, bright, we're still addicted to feeling. We want these feelings of pleasure or equanimity. We enjoy them. Even on the level of firm concentration or meditative absorption, there's attachment to the feeling. This is the subtle magnetic pull of craving, which paints and plasters things over. It's hard to detect because craving is always whispering, "I want nothing but pleasant feelings." This is very important, for this virus of craving is what causes us to be continually reborn. So explore how craving paints and plasters things, how it causes desires to form, the desires to get this or take that, and how its addictive flavor makes it hard for you to pull away. You have to see how craving fastens the mind so firmly to feelings that you never weary of sensuality or of pleasant feelings, no matter what kind. If you don't see clearly that the mind is stuck right here at feeling and craving, it will keep you from gaining release. We're stuck on feeling like a monkey and stuck in a tar trap. They take a glob of tar and put it where a monkey will get its hand stuck in it, and in trying to pull free, the monkey gets its other hand, both feet, and finally its mouth stuck too. Consider this. Whatever we do, we end up stuck right here at feeling and craving. We can't separate them out. We can't wash them off. If we don't grow weary of craving, we're like the monkey stuck in tar. So if we're intent on freeing ourselves in the footsteps of the arahants, we have to focus specifically on feeling until we succumb. We can succeed in freeing ourselves from it. Even with painful feelings, we have to practice. For if we're afraid of pain and always try to change it to pleasure, we'll end up even more ignorant than before. This is why we have to be brave in experimenting with pain, both physical pain and mental distress. When it arises in full measure, like a house afire, can we let go of it? We have to know both sides of feeling. When it's hot and burning, how can we deal with it? When it's cool and refreshing, how can we see through it? We have to make an effort to focus on both sides, contemplating until we know how to let go. Otherwise, we won't know anything, for all we want is the cool side. The cooler, the better. And when this is the case, how can we expect to gain release from the cycle of rebirth? Nibbana is the extinguishing of craving, and yet we like to stick with craving. So how can we expect to get anywhere? We'll stay right here in the world, right here with stress and suffering, for craving is a sticky sap. If there's no craving, there's nothing, no stress, no rebirth. But we have to watch out for it. It's a sticky sap, a glob of tar, a dye that's hard to wash out. So don't let yourself get carried away with feeling. The crucial part of the practice lies here.
Can you venture a guess as to what word Ajahn Jeff is translating as stop formations?
Probably sankhara. Which sankhara in the Thai but they use a long time in terms of that as the sort of mental formations. So it's pretty much, especially in terms of Dhamma, a Dhamma practice and Upasika Geek holds pretty close to the suttas. So.
In another Ajahn Jeff translation, I think similar to that, I saw that he used the word supposing, or supposings, and fashioning, and fashionings. Is that
right?
The same?
Supposings usually is the word is samut, which is, you know, like that. That's assumptions, maybe. Supposings, assumptions. Say, like Ajahn Chah would oftentimes use that in contradistinction to vimut, samut and vimut, so because they're close to each other. So one is the supposings and the imaginings, assumptions, and then vimut is freedom and liberation.
Or did Vasuki, did she focus on Vedana more than other things, or was that just this chapter?
Well, the thing is I think her focus was really on insight rather than Vedana. And Vedana is fairly, and I'd say a direct avenue exploring that basis, but I think her emphasis is much more on the aspects of insight and penetration, and Vedana is just an avenue for exploration.
During her lifetime, did she have a lot of followers or not?
She did. She would have in her, like in the little bio thing that Debbie said that there's still at the time of the translation, which was sometime after her death, there was 50 or 60 people or something like that, and during her lifetime that was pretty standard. She had a very solid community. There were usually 40, 50, 60 people practicing at any one given time. And tons of monkeys. It's one of the things of practicing at Kalsala Long. It's pretty much everybody's issued a stick as you come in. It's part of the practice to keep the monkeys away. They're pretty. They have the run of the whole place. They're really, they can be really annoying.
Would it be possible to give a working definition of sankhara? It seems like sankhara has been used by different people and just my experience, just everything from gross, you know, like thought formations to all this, any sort of subtle formation, like, you know, seeing some authors say that, like, you know, Sanyana and Vedana and Vijnana, those are all Sankara as well.
Yes. Well, see, the thing is, this Sankara is used in different contexts.
Mm.
So that they, I mean, it's a word that, that literally, you know, means, you know, being something of a compounded nature. That's its kind of broadest meaning. But then it's used in the context of the khandhas, which then it's a mental formation. And then it's characterized by volition, so it has a specific use or connotation in that context. But then it's used in terms of, say, like in the broadest, kind of like in the morning chanting, where we say sabbe sankhara anicca, so all things of a compounded nature are impermanent. Then it covers everything outside of Nibbana. But then it's, you know, there's also, I'd say, a bodily formation, which is then you're talking about the actual physical body, because sometimes it's used as a noun, sometimes it's used as a verb. You know, so it has a very broad usage. Like the Kaya Sankara, that which conditions, it's like as a conditioner, something that is conditioning and compounding the body. So then it's generally referred to in terms of the breath. So it just has such a broad application. So there isn't one working definition. You have to see the context of what's used.